Chapter 65. At noon the next day, after landing at the Corpus Christi Naval Air Station, Pitt and Lily, along with Admiral Sandecker, were driven by a seaman first class to NUMA's Ocean Research Center on the bay. Sandecker directed the driver to stop beside a helicopter squatting on a concrete pad beside a long dock. There were no clouds. The sun was alone in the sky. The temperature was mild, but the humidity high, and they quickly began to sweat after exiting the car. NUMA's chief geologist, Herb Garza, gave a friendly wave and approached. He was short, plump, brown-skinned, with a few pockmarks on his cheeks and gleaming black hair. Garza wore a California Angels baseball cap and a fluorescent orange shirt that was so blasting Pitt could still see it after he momentarily closed his eyes. "Dr. Garza," said Sandecker curtly, "good to see you again."
"I've looked forward to your arrival," Garza said warmly. "We can take off as soon as you board."
He turned and introduced the pilot, Joe Mifflin, who wore Smilin' Jack sunglasses and struck Pitt as being about as animated as a doorknob. Pitt and Garza had worked together on a project along the western desert stretch of coast in South Africa.
"How long has it been, Herb?" said Pitt. 3, 4 years?
"Who counts?" Garza said with a broad smile as they shook hands. "Good to be on the same team with you again.
May I introduce Dr. Lily Sharp?"
Garza graciously bowed.
"One of the ocean sciences?" he asked.
Lily shook her head.
"Land archaeology."
Garza turned and stared at Sandecker with a curious expression.
"This isn't a sea project, Admiral?"
"No, I'm sorry you weren't fully informed, Herb, but I'm afraid we'll have to keep the real purpose of our work a secret for a little longer."
Garza shrugged indifferently.
"You're the boss."
"All I need is a direction," said Mifflin.
"South," Pitt told him, "south to the Rio Grande."
They dropped down the coast along the intercoastal waterway, passing over the hotels and condominiums of South Padre Island. Then Mifflin ducked the green helicopter with the NUMA letters on the side under a layer of popcorn-puffed clouds and swung west below Port Isabel, where the waters of the Rio Grande spilled into the Gulf of Mexico. The land below was a strange blend of marsh and desert, flat as a parking lot, with cactus growing amid tall grass. Soon the city of Brownsville appeared through the windshield. The river narrowed as it flowed under the bridge connecting Texas to Matamoros, Mexico.
"Can you tell me what we're supposed to survey?" asked Garza.
"You grew up in the Rio Grande Valley, didn't you?" Sandecker queried without answering.
"Born and raised upriver at Laredo. Took my undergraduate courses at Texas Southernmost College in Brownsville. We just passed over it."
"Then you're familiar with the geology around Roma?"
"I've conducted a number of field trips in the area, yes."
It was Pitt's turn. "Compared to now, how did the river flow a few centuries after Christ?"
"The stream wasn't much different then," answered Garza. "Oh, sure, the course has shifted during earlier flooding, but seldom more than a couple of miles. Quite often over the centuries it returned to its previous course. The major change is that the Rio Grande would have been considerably higher then. Until the war with Mexico, the width ran from 200 to 400 meters. The main channel actually was much deeper."
"When was it first seen by a European?"
"Alonso de Pineda sailed into the river's mouth in 1519.
"How did it stack up to the Mississippi back then?"
Garza thought a moment.
"The Rio Grande was more akin to the Nile."
"Nile?"
"The headwaters begin in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. During the spring flooding season, as the winter snows melted, the water swept down the lower reaches in huge surges. The ancient Indians, like the Egyptians, dug ditches so the high water ran to their crops. That's why the river you see now is a mere trickle of its former self. As the Spanish and Mexican settlers moved in, followed by the Texas Americans, new irrigation works were built. After the Civil War, railroads brought in more farmers and ranchers, who siphoned off more water. By 1894, shallow and dangerous shoals put an end to steamboating. If there had been no irrigation, the Rio Grande might have been the Mississippi River of Texas."
"Steamboats ran on the Rio Grande?" asked Lily.
"For a short time, traffic was quite heavy as trade developed up and down and on both sides of the river. Fleets of paddle steamers made regular runs from Brownsville to Laredo for over 30 years.
Now, since they built the Falcon Dam, about the only craft you see on the lower river are outboard boats and inner tubes.
Could sailing vessels have navigated as far as Roma? Asked Pitt.
With room to spare. The river was easily wide enough for tacking. All a ship with sails had to do was wait for easterly offshore breezes. One keelboat made it as far northwest as Santa Fe in 1850.
They fell quiet for a few minutes as Mifflin followed the meandering turns of the river. A few low rolling hills appeared. On the Mexican side, little towns first settled nearly 300 years ago sat in dusty seclusion. Some houses were built of stone and adobe and topped by red tile, while the outskirts were dotted with small primitive huts having thatched roofs. The agricultural part of the valley, with its citrus groves and fields of vegetables and aloe vera, gave way to arid plains of mesquite trees and white thistle. Pitt expected a muddy brown river, but the Rio Grande pleasantly surprised him by running a deep green.
We're coming up on Roma now, announced Garza. The sister city across the river is called Miguel Alemán. Not much of a town. Except for some tourist curio stores, it's mostly a border crossing on the road to Monterrey.
Mifflin pulled up and soared over the international bridge and then dropped low on the river again. On the Mexican side, men and women were washing cars, mending fishing nets, and swimming. Along the bank, a few pigs wallowed in the silt. On the American side, a yellowish sandstone bluff rose from the riverbank up to the main section of downtown Roma. The buildings appeared to be quite old, and some were run down, but all seemed in sound condition. One or two were in stages of reconstruction.
The buildings look very quaint, said Lily. There must be a lot of history behind their walls.
Roma was a busy port during the commercial and military boating era, Garza lectured. Prosperous merchants hired architects to design some very interesting homes and business structures, and they've lasted quite well.
Anyone more famous than the others? Asked Lily.
Famous, Garza laughed. My pick would be a residence built in the middle 1800s that was used as Rosita's Cantina when the movie Viva Zapata was filmed in Roma with Marlon Brando.
Sandecker gestured for Mifflin to circle the hills above the town. He turned to Garza.
Is Roma named after Rome because it's surrounded by seven hills?
Nobody really knows for sure, replied Garza. You'd be hard-pressed to pick out seven distinctive hills. A couple have noticeable peaks, but mostly they just run into each other.
What's the geology? Pitt inquired as he stared downward.
Cretaceous debris for the most part. This whole area was once under the sea. Fossil oyster shells are common. Some have been found that measure half a meter. There's a nearby gravel pit that illustrates the various geological periods. I can give you a quick lecture if you care to have Joe set us down.
Not just yet, said Pitt. Are there any natural caves in the region?
None visible on the surface, but that doesn't mean they aren't down there. No way of knowing how many caves formed by the ancient seas are hidden under the upper layer. Go deep enough in the right spot and you will likely strike a good-sized limestone deposit. Old Indian legends tell of spirits living underground.
What sort of spirits?
Garza shrugged. Ghosts of the ancients who died in battle with evil gods.
Lily unconsciously clutched Pitt's arm.
Have any artifacts been discovered near Roma?
A few arrow and spear flints, stone knives, and boat stones.
What are boat stones? Asked Pitt.
Hollow stones in the shape of boat hulls, answered Lily with mounting excitement. Their exact origin or purpose is obscure. It's thought they were used as charms. They supposedly warded off evil, especially if an Indian feared a witch or power of a shaman. An effigy of the witch was tied to a boat stone and thrown into a lake or river, destroying the evil forever.
Pitt put another question to Garza. Any objects turn up that confound the historic timescale?
Some, but they were considered to be fake.
Lily put on her best casual expression.
What sort of objects?
Swords, crosses, bits and pieces of armor, spear shafts, mostly made of iron. I also recall the story of an old stone anchor that was dug out of the bluff beside the river.
Probably Spanish in origin, ventured Sandecker guardedly.
Garza shook his head. Not Spanish, but Roman. State museum officials were justifiably skeptical. They wrote them off as a 19th century hoax. Lily's hand bit deeper into Pitt's arm.
"Any possibility of my having a look at them?" she asked in an anxious voice. "Or have they been lost and forgotten, packed away in the dust of a state university basement?"
Garza pointed out the window toward the road running north from Roma. "As a matter of fact, the artifacts are right down there. They've been kept and collected by the man who found most of them. A good old Texan boy named Sam Trinity, or Crazy Sam as he's known by the locals. He's poked around this area for 50 years, swearing a Roman army camped here. Makes a living by running a small gas station and store. Has a shack in the rear he grandly calls a museum of antiquity."
Pitt smiled slowly.
"Can you set us down beside his place?" he asked Mifflin. "I think we ought to have a talk with Sam."